Hello, and welcome to the live book business webinar, Build Your Bottom Line with Strategic Content Management, sponsored by RSI Content Solutions, the makers of RSuite CMS. I'm Brian Howard. I am the editor-in-chief of Book Business Magazine, and for the next 60 minutes, the host of today's event. Now, I'm particularly excited about today's event as we have three great speakers with a lot of really deep knowledge on the topic of how publishers can be more efficient, more agile, and yes, make more money by taking a strategic approach to how they manage their most precious commodity, their content. Now, the way this will work is once I wrap up my spiel here, I'll hand things off to our moderator, Bill Kasdorf, who'll give an overview of the topic, and then our publisher speakers, John Shaw of Sage Publications and Anthony Allen of the American Society for Training and Development, will present you with case studies. And we'll leave plenty of time for our esteemed panel to answer questions from you, the audience. Now, before I get started, I need to do a little housekeeping and give you a few very quick tips on how you can make the most of today's live webinar. First, if at any point you have any technical difficulties, you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or just let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please don't be shy. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all of the widgets, wingdings, and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. Now, before I introduce today's speakers, I'd like to introduce the sponsor of today's webinar, RSI Content Solutions. In addition to today's webinar, RSI and Book Business are collaborating on a white paper on this topic, which will be made available to attendees of this webinar in the next couple of weeks. Now, allow me to briefly give the floor to Marianne Kalohana of RSI.
Thank you, Brian. So a little bit about RSI Content Solutions. We started in 2000 as a consulting company, and we help publishers with XML and content management-related technologies. Today, RSI is a software company, and we are the folks behind RSuite CMS, the only content management system designed specifically for publishers. And now, to set a high-level picture of what we're going to talk about in this webinar, I wanted to look at a very simplified view of our industry. In the past, the publishing process was linear, and that is create content, edit content, and print content. That's no longer the case. It's far from a straightforward linear process. Generally speaking, today, stresses on the publishing industry are even more accelerated than for most other industries. New expenses are added to reach publishing targets, and those expenses don't always add up to total revenue. A content management system is a publisher's factory. The factory must be able to meet new revenue opportunities quickly and affordably. It must be efficient in operations, especially for delivery to digital and print, and the factory must protect your assets. RSuite CMS is RSI's enterprise content management system designed specifically for publishers and media organizations. RSuite CMS is used to store, manage, edit, and deliver content. In 2006, the first version of RSuite was released, and today RSuite serves a number of publishing verticals, including scientific, technical, medical publishers, educational publishers, scholarly publishers, legal publishers, religious publishers, and many more. So, Brian, I'm going to return it over to you and the rest of our great panel. Thank you.
Thanks, Marianne. Okay, now I'm going to introduce you to today's speakers on building your bottom line with strategic content management. First, from Sage Publications, we have John Shaw. John has been Executive Director of Publishing Technologies with Sage for 18 years. During his tenure, John has held management roles in composition, abstracts production, and journals production. John currently heads up Sage and CQ Press's global electronic publishing program, including electronic peer review, journal and books hosting systems, electronic production systems, content management strategies, content archiving, and content conversion. We also have, from the American Society for Training and Development, Anthony Allen. Anthony is digital architect at the ASTD, where he manages a wide range of print and digital content products. Anthony is also an adjunct professor of technology at the George Mason College of Visual and Performing Arts and has previously worked in media production at Discovery Studios with the Discovery Channel and the CIA. And last but certainly not least, we have today's moderator, Bill Kasdorf. Bill is the general editor of the Columbia Guide to Digital Publishing, the vice president and principal consultant of Apex Content Solutions, a leading supplier of data conversion, editorial, production, and content enhancement services to publishers and other organizations worldwide. Active in many standards initiatives, Bill serves on the IDPF working group developing the EPUB 3 standard, the IDEA Alliance working group developing the next pub PSV source format for magazines and other design and feature-rich publications, the NISO ebook SIG, and is chair of the BISG Content Structure Committee. The past president of the Society for Scholarly Publishing, Bill has led seminars, written articles, and spoken widely for publishing industry organizations. And with that, I'd like to hand things over to you, Bill.
Great. Thanks a lot, Brian. We're jumping ahead here. I just want to get oriented. I've called this somewhat tongue-in-cheek content management by the numbers because I want to give you the illusion that this is simple and straightforward. So the first number is 4. My colleagues know that I have a tendency to talk about the 4 most meaningless terms in digital publishing, and here they are. The first one is digitization. So what do you mean by digitization? It can mean just scanning. It can mean scanning an OCR. It can mean complete tagging end-to-end with XML, et cetera, et cetera. So just saying you're digitizing something really doesn't tell you much. Next most meaningless term is XML. Same thing. You could do anything with XML. Saying begin, start book, blah, 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 end book can be valid XML for a book, but it's totally useless. You have to say what the XML is for, how you're using it, et cetera. So just saying XML really doesn't tell you anything. Indexing. Another now meaningless term. Does it mean the back of the book indexing? Does it mean what Google does, which is keeping track of all the words in all the documents, or everything in between? And so the topic today is the 4th most meaningless term is content management, or CMS. So I'm going to delve into some things that it might mean, 6 things that people sometimes mean when they talk about content management. First one is web content management. So this is about managing what's on your website. This is not necessarily publishing. Businesses, et cetera, use web content management to manage their websites. So here's some kind of common things that you hear in a context that's just focused on web content management. They throw their print publications over the wall and let the IT geeks put them on the web. This is all post-print, typically, and there's a delay in getting the materials online. And when they need EPUBs, they probably send them out to an outsourcing firm, actually like the one I work for, to create the EPUBs. Another thing that content management might mean is digital asset management, related but not exactly the same thing. This is about managing all the stuff. So the reason that you need this is for situations like this. Do you remember what you named that file? Why is this image taking so long to load? Well, it's the wrong version of the image. Didn't we create this diagram for a project a year or two ago? I can tell you I encounter this all the time in my consulting work where a publisher is spending time, money, and effort recreating something they don't realize that somebody else in their organization already created basically the same thing. And, of course, making sure you've got what you need when you need it. Next thing it might mean is workflow management. So this is about who does what when. So has this thing been copy edited yet? Has anybody proofread it? I kind of think I kind of sent the wrong file to the printer. Has anybody ever heard that said? I bet you have. My favorite one today is, you mean we're actually supposed to check the EPUBs? Very common. People get boatloads of EPUBs and they never even look at them to see if they're okay. Another thing, the 4th thing that it might mean is XML workflow management. So So now we're getting interesting here. One of my runner-ups for meaningless terms is XML first. This means lots of different things to different people. Does it mean that all the digital products are created from XML? Does it mean that the print pages are actually typeset from the same XML? Does it mean you're actually copy editing in XML? Does it mean you're actually authoring in XML? Frankly, what I tell people XML first means is typically it means XML from where I sit in the workflow and downstream from me. That's typically what XML first means in the real world. I sound like I'm anti-XML. I'm extremely pro-XML, and I'm extremely pro-XML first. My point is that these terms are mushy terms, and you need to be very much clear. You need to be clear about how you're using these terms. Fifth thing is XML repository management, another cool thing. So, you know, typically people build the content of the repository out of the products, the publications that they create. But increasingly, they're building products and publications from the content in the repository. And, of course, the important thing to realize is you can do both. It's not an either-or. Increasingly, publishers are moving to that publish-to-the-repository strategy where, yes, they do have to get their day-to-day products out, but in the meantime, they're building a repository that is has great value for the future. It's not just done when that one book is done. The sixth thing, and I think the best thing that content management might mean, is all of the above. Let me also mention three things that content management might mean, but it actually doesn't usually mean. One is title management. These are the basically big database systems that are all about the metadata, managing acquisition and development information, scheduling, monitoring the workflow, cost estimating, budgeting, invoice processing, balancing the load among workers and vendor management, marketing and sales, et cetera. Another thing that people might think content management means, it usually doesn't, is digital asset distribution. So this is about how you send the end products out to your customers, the EPUBs, the apps, the PDFs, print on demand, all the variant ebook files for the different readers like Kindle and Nook and Kobo, et cetera, getting all the metadata to the retailers and the aggregators. Last thing I want to point out that it might mean, but it doesn't usually, is the web hosting. And I want to be clear here that this is about making your content available online, not to be confused with the cloud, which is a recently popular term, which is about how you're using your own content in your own workflow. I will point out about these three things that these are all good things, and actually good CMSs can and do some of these things. But I just wanted to point out that usually when people are talking about content management, these three kinds of systems, the title management systems, the digital asset distribution, and the web hosting, usually are not what they mean by that. So let's look at another important number. How many content management systems are there? I think it would be an exaggeration to say a gazillion, but it's pretty safe to say at least half a gazillion. There are a ton of things that can be considered content management systems. There's a little Bender map that another consulting firm did that tries to make sense of all the different systems that deal with managing and manipulating content. So, obviously, you've probably inferred that my preference is an XML-based workflow-focused CMS. I think that's really how you get the best value out of a content management system. What are some of the best reasons to use a system like this? Well, first of all, efficiency. You can automate a lot of things that you're doing manually right now, running a transform, an XSLT, sending an email to somebody, notifying somebody, reminding somebody of something. There's a ton of manual inefficiency in most workflows, and a good content management system can automate that. Triggering those processes automatically, doing the alerts, the notifications, transferring files, eliminating redundant steps, helping you create multiple products from one set of content, and just basically keeping track of stuff. Very, very important reason. Obviously, economy. You don't do this to spend money. You do this to save money. And obviously, it helps you streamline your workflows, and that you're doing that to save money. It also makes it much easier and more economical to create derivative products. It makes it much easier to interface with partners and vendors because it basically lowers the transaction overhead. You've got a much more streamlined way of dealing with everybody from, you know, printers and web developers to copy editors and proofreaders and designers that you might hire as freelancers. A CMS really streamlines, eliminates a lot of the overhead in interacting with all those people and just avoiding rework and duplicated efforts. Predictability is something that people often kind of overlook, but it's a really important thing about a good content management system. One thing, in an earlier life, I was involved in a printing organization, and we did a lot of kind of process management. One of the things that was really startling to realize is that in most workflows, less than 10% of the time is actually process time, and 90% of the time is queue time. Something is just sitting waiting for somebody to do something to it. And one of the things that a good CMS can do is really trim down that queue time so that people get things when they're ready to be worked on, they know the priorities, and they work on things promptly rather than having things sit. And also, it gives you accountability. Everybody knows what happens when, and it's much easier to maintain schedules. In fact, I think I've got accountability as my next reason. The responsibilities are clearer, the system helps people keep on track, and it keeps a record of everything. Very useful thing for you. Versatility. You don't want to think of a CMS as requiring you to be rigid. You can generate multiple products from a single source, as I've mentioned a couple of times. When there are kind of forks in the road in your workflow, the CMS can help you navigate that efficiently. And I guess the bottom line I want to point out is that being systematic does not have to mean being rigid. And then agility, the ability to respond quickly to opportunities, incorporating new technologies, adopting new platforms, managing your content in a very granular form, create digital products before print, a great thing. And reason number 7, quality. Reason number 8, quality. Reason number 9, quality. This is what it's really all about. Poor quality is such a waste of time and money and energy. A good CMS really helps you get things right, keeps you on track, keeps your products meeting specs, meeting schedules, et cetera. This really is the one and only main reason for doing it. All the rest lead to that. Here's another important number, the number of content management systems that are magic. You guessed it, 0. They're not magic. They only work if you work to make them work. So that's actually one of the good things about implementing a content management system. I've seen this happen over and over again where a publisher really improves their workflow by doing this, not just because they're using this automated tool, but the process of implementing a CMS helps you think through your workflow and discover inefficiencies, discover redundancies, et cetera, analyzing your workflow, your models, XML models, et cetera, that you're using, the products you're creating, the plans for the future, so that you know what you want the CMS to do. And I really stress you want to start with that. Think these things through before you just go buy a CMS and say, you think you can plug it in and it solves your problems. You need to think about what you want it to do. Who does what in your workflow? What works and what doesn't? What can you automate, et cetera? And as I said, a CMS really helps you think that through and develop that. For some reason, I'm not clicking the right button here. Sorry. So at this point, I will turn the slides over to my good friend John Shaw from Sage, and he will talk about how this is actually done in the real world. So, John, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. You really have set the context for this next set of slides that I'm going to present, and hopefully you believe that we followed a few of those good tips that you've provided there. Of
you
course,
sure
maybe a few we didn't, so... Anyway, thanks everyone for joining, and hopefully we can walk through a little bit of kind of the process that we used in determining how we are going to build a subset of what you could call content management. I think it's good to start off by saying that, like everyone, you go into a project, and specifically when you're thinking about CMS, and you say, we need a CMS, and very quickly you start figuring out that CMS means so many things, such as Bill pointed out. And before you can ever succeed implementing a CMS or some kind of strategy, you really have to define what it is you mean and carve out a subset of what you're trying to accomplish, what's going to bring the biggest amount of return for your business. And so that's what we did when developing the Sage Online Content Repository. So actually, this is the agenda that we're going to run through really quickly here today for you. If no one or if you have not heard of SAGE, that's just a quick overview. I'm not going to really talk too much about it, but just wanted to give you a little bit of context of who we are so you understand kind of where our needs might be. The challenge that we really had at SAGE, and you always have this problem, I can't say you're ever through it, but the problem that you see that you have is that there's a lot of content within your organization. And in this sense, I've carved out what content means. So to make it easier, I've just broken out into three groups. And there is more content than this, but I've just tried to simplify it. So the largest sets of content that we have would be journals, books, and reference content. And then from there, what you have on the right side of this slide is specifically just looking at some of the places that our content was going. So we have SAGE journals, we have SAGE research methods, we have SAGE knowledge and ebook platform, and there are other places where the content is actually going as well. Then what we also find at that point is that with the content, you need to do more than just send the content to those online platforms. You actually need to enrich the content, or you need to do additional work on it, or you need to do some type of analytics. Before you know it, you have a lot of content going to a lot of places that need content which needs a lot of help. So it becomes very complex, and if you think about the time that it could take without a system, you can quickly become mired down and having a lot of employees wasting their time or doing things very manually where you need more systematic process, as Bill spoke about. So what we came up with, and this was a good amount of years ago now, is the fact that we really needed a system and we really needed some process. As Bill said, before before and during you're in this process, you also start learning about what you're really doing within the business, and it's scary to figure all that out. You definitely pull some skeletons out of closets when you're figuring out what you're really doing in the organization, where content's really not going, or how much content you lost, or how inefficient a process may be. So in the process of figuring out what the system was that we needed, we kind of started coming up with new process along the way. In the case of the slide you see here, you see that this looks a little more organized than what we saw in the last slide. So just quickly, and again, I'm not going to run through all of the bullets here, but this really kind of hits at the problems that we are looking at. We had a lot of content, and it was in a lot of formats, and that was years ago. That was in 2005 that we believed that we had a lot of content. We've easily doubled, tripled, quadrupled the amount of content that we have, and that's through digitization projects, acquisitions, and whatnot. And so as you think about the ebook revolution and all the different formats that exist there, you realize that you're going to continue to get more content in, you're going to continue to have more formats, and so forth. And we also knew that the more content you got, we just need to store that content very reliably, and a file server just wasn't going to cut it in the future. So with that, we also needed to do something with the content. We were spending a lot of people's time actually manually loading things to FTP sites, making sure it got onto those sites, and so forth. And then more recently, content's not good enough as it is. You really need to actually enrich it to make it better, to make it findable on the open net. And then we get to, just the general objectives. Like I said, you can go into it saying you need a CMS, but you quickly find that that's kind of a rat's nest. You really need to define what it is you're trying to get at. So we defined a few different objectives, the absolute priorities of the project. And in this sense, we knew we needed to secure those assets. We were losing almost as much content as we were digitizing. It was disappearing. There was no lockdown of it. It would change. You didn't have any version control and whatnot. So that became very scary, and we had to solve that problem quickly. We needed to enforce encoding quality standards. You'd get content back from your vendors, but it wouldn't always be in the right format. So we needed to be able to quickly and reliably make sure that content was of high quality standards that we were looking for. We needed to be able to scale the delivery of the content that we needed to get out for many different reasons, whether it was delivering it back to one of our society partners, delivering it downstream to a customer, putting it on our own platforms, or sending it up for discoverability, whether it's going to Google or Microsoft or wherever it may go. And then the last point is just with enrichment and analyzing and discovering the content. We wanted to have a robust process in doing that. The background, just generally, just to help you understand, we did choose to go down a path of calling something a content repository. We didn't call it a complete content management system because, one, as Bill stated, there's no real definition for it. But a repository is what we are really looking to do. We needed to hold the content, ingest the content. We need to deliver the content. We also needed to be a platform to enrich it, and we needed the ability to transform in there and reliably store and go from there. So we called it a content repository, or SOCR for short. In 2005, we began those business, the general business plans and getting approvals. And that took a while. We had to really carve out that definition of what the project was going to be. So in 2005, we got that, got the approvals. We began speccing and developing in 2006. About 2 years later, we had the first version of the system. At that point, we were happy, but not happy enough. We already had moved our business requirements up, so it was a constant movement. So we essentially released a whole new version in 2011, and then we're quickly now speeding up and kind of doing point versions to add on additional products into this. And just quickly, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a visualization of what the SOCR or Sage Online Content Repository is doing. As much as I kind of went through this, this helps in a visual manner give a good definition of what the system is doing today. So we're storing that content, ingesting it in. We have the ability to edit the content and, of course, also check the content to make sure it has the quality that we're looking for. And we can deliver the content. We can deliver it and transform it. We can put it up in different packages. And on all of that, we can do analytics within the platform itself. So it's simple, but yet there's extremely complex business rules sitting behind that. And again, this helps you get it in a visualized form of what's happening within the system itself. And here, this gives you a better feeling for what we're doing on our journals and specifically. We generally get a lot of content back, whether it be from our typesetters or whether it be back file congestions. We're taking that content in, ingesting it, storing it reliably, and, of course, when need be, we're delivering it back out. And you can see we do have many, many locations of where that content is going. And to help kind of give you just a bit of context of how we deliver, there's the general places where it goes. So generally hosting and then people who license content, or we're sending it back to society partners so they can put it in their own systems. Then moving through, we have the discoverability channels that we send through, just a subset of lists just to give you a context of kind of where the content is going out of the system. And then lastly, we look at some more discoverability partners that just keep on going on and on and on. So we set out with the system in 2005, as I've mentioned, and what we've gotten to this point up until 2012 is really trying to get all of our journal content in the system. What we did learn along this process is it took a lot longer than we ever thought. So the speccing, you know, was challenging, but now looking back, that was one of the easier processes to actually continue to work through the workflows, make sure the system is doing what you need, and to get the right business rules to do what you need to do to automate the process and get the quality you want just takes a good amount of time. And, of course, each business is going to be a little different based on the requirements. So up through 2012, we've been still working on getting the journal content ingested in the right formats and running the way we want it. And, of course, there's always new development and new support there. And then starting here in 2012, we also began ingesting books. And the books requirements really have been changing through the last couple of years because of the industry evolving. And so the timing actually worked out fairly well for us to start developing this functionality within the system. We wanted the system to be very strong and capable of what we needed it to do. We also needed robust business rules within the system to do the infrastructure, the undercore infrastructure of what we needed to handle books. The books process in some ways is easier on some levels, and in some levels far more complex. There's a lot more variance in the XML flavors that are going on, and there's still a lot of standards that are changing on a daily basis. we're also changing up the standards of how we do encoding of our books, and so we're trying to go to a centralized hub format. It's essentially an HTML format, and of course I do thank Phil Kasdorf for helping us on that, of coming up to one central format that we use that we can then transform downstream into all the different flavors of XML that we need to supply all the different vendors or platforms or wherever the content must go. And then as we look about future development, we want to do more within the system. So we do use Temis as a partner, and we do have some detailed goals of trying to do more of that within the system, or at least making sure we're capturing all the enrichment that we're doing or applied terms from taxonomies into the system itself. So we do want all aspects of the online content to be sitting within Soccer. And that, in a nutshell, is really what we're doing with this particular system. As I mentioned, it's a work in progress. It never slows down, and it's always a fun but new day with what the business requirements are. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Anthony, and he's going to talk about more of where they're going in their organization with the systems.
Great. Thanks. Thanks so much, John. So ASTD, if you I've never heard of ASTD. We are an association that represents corporate trainers. So the content that we produce helps corporate trainers give better sales training or project management training or leadership training within organizations. So we publish 20 books a year. We have a monthly and a quarterly magazine. We have a monthly 20-page supplement on a specific training document. And the shelf life of our content is actually quite long. The way that adults learn and what constitutes good learning theory really hasn't changed much over the past 20 years with the exception of learning technology. So I would say that our useful repository is probably about like 20, 22, 25,000 pages of content. So starting in 2007, ASTD, we have this content management initiative, and that's why I was hired at ASTD. And I won't go too much into the details of our requirements, but we created a repository. We got our content into XML. We tagged it to our taxonomy. And we also put on top of everything this production workflow engine, which is R Suite for us, and actually has been performing quite well for us. We're very happy with it. And we're really happy with where we are in the process right now. And once all that heavy lifting was finished, and it took about 3 years to really to do that, and through that, kind of to echo what John was saying, we didn't know how long it was going to take. Part of that process was, of course, the human change and changing the way that ASTD looked at content and reused its content. And where we are now is this new phase of growth where we're really not looking at content as discrete units, but we're really looking at content as a service. And that's the real main point that I'm going to try to communicate to everybody is to look at your content like a service. And I don't know if anybody remembers when the Kindle Fire came out, Jeff Bezos was constantly talking about the services, content as a service, apps as a service, the whole ecosystem is really, that word service just kept getting repeated. And that's really where ASTD has gone as well. So when you think of content reuse, you need to think about content services that helps your customers solve specific problems. And that's really the fun part for me. You know, we did all this hard work, so now let's build some services that actually get our content out of the system and into users' hands, the right content at the right time. So I was just going to talk about two of these services that we've built. So this first service is called ASTD Streams, and it's a choose your own adventure through our entire content library, and it's an HTML5 app, and it pulls content chunks directly from our content repository. So if you have a chunk on your phone, you can click on any word or group of words in the chunk, and the queries run against the repository, and you get back the next most relevant piece of information based on the word or words that you clicked. So it's kind of like the Google I'm Feeling Lucky button for our ASTD content repository. So because we converted all of our content to XML, the XML is aware of the sections at the subtopic level. And so what I mean by that is you have a book, you have a chapter within a book, you have a section within the book, and then you even have sections within that section. So the XML is aware of all of that. And that can be anywhere from a few paragraphs to a few pages, and it's delivered to the user's phone. And there's also information about what book and what chapter that chunk came from. So there's context as well, and of course all those links go back to our store where you can purchase that book. So it's a fun little marketing app. It can be used for casual research as well. But the main point with this is, you know, there's, I don't know, actually thinking about it right now, I should probably ask one of our developers to run a query and find out how many subtopics there actually are. But the point here is that being able to build an app like this and leveraging the XML, we now have, I guess, hundreds of thousands of these chunks that people can use in a self-service model. And just imagine, you know, it's not the perfect solution. The perfect solution would probably be for me to hire 20 people and give them all of our books and say, okay, now write, you know, succinct, summaries of all these content to make it a little more digestible for people when on their phones. But I don't have the budget to hire 20 people. So this kind of app that leverages the XML is really the next best thing, and it really is a service, and it actually is revenue generating, and it does link back to all of the products that we offer to our members and non-members. So the second service that I wanted to talk about is a lot of companies are doing this. It's kind of like, you know, building your own custom Frankenstein book, Frankenbook. And so this is a service that we're building where users can build their own courses, and they can rearrange the slides. If you look at the first green square on the left-hand side, you're going to choose what type of course you want to build, and is it an innovation training, is it leadership training, is it sales training, and then the next screen on the right-hand side comes up, and you get to actually, you know, modularize your learning and pick and choose what sections you want to put into the PowerPoints, to the leader's guide, and into the student's guide. And so this is a course that a trainer would actually give at a corporation, whether it's leadership or innovation training or what have you. So the interesting part, or the services part of this, is that you can also browse ASTD's content and pull it into your course. So the reason that's important for us is really from a workflow, from a resources perspective, when our repository is updated with new content, well, that content is available for reuse immediately in this service without us having to do anything. And that's incredibly important for us just in terms of growth, time to market. So that's really what I had to talk about today with both of these services. It's really quick time to market in development. You know, the amount of time between, hey, I have a great idea for a service, and boom, that service is out the door, is a lot shorter because we don't have to go back and do a lot of legwork for two reasons. The first one is that the content is in XML, and the second one is that we do have a CMS in our suite that allows us to build very, very quickly on top of that. So that's what I had to talk about today, and we can start off with some questions.
Okay, so we've covered quite a bit of ground on strategic content management today, and we've got a lineup of questions from the audience, and I'm going to hand things over to Bill to handle that. Are you still on the line, Bill?
I am here, and I apologize. I actually was talking, but I forgot that I put my phone on mute while the speakers were speaking. So, thanks, Brian. I'm happy to handle the questions, and we wanted about 20 minutes for questions, and we've got exactly 20 minutes for questions, so that's just perfect. And we have a number of questions. I've actually got a couple of questions that I'd like to ask John and Anthony, too, but we'll start with the questions coming in from the audience. Let's see. Brian, should I be guided by your prioritization that you've got on our Q&A screen that I'm watching here?
You can take them in any order you want, but I sort of arranged them by when they came in by the audience. So.
I wanted to pick up on one that is one of the earlier ones that came in that was directed to me, because I think it points to an interesting issue that is relevant to both of these speakers, and that is, are there or should there be any distinctions between book publishing and magazine publishing with regard to content management? The reality is that right now, yes, there are big differences. We're moving to a future where those differences are diminishing or disappearing. But I, as Brian mentioned when he introduced me, I work on a number of different standards groups, one of which is in the magazine industry, developing a model for content description. It's largely a metadata standard. It's built on one called PRISM. One really important insight is that magazine content tends to be created and managed and used in a much more granular way than book content typically is. In this model, in fact, the content for the magazines is not even really stored as a publication. It's stored as resources, articles, images, videos, ads, letters, etc. And then those things are assembled into a publication, whereas typically book publishers think of the product first. They're still very product-focused, so they create a book, implement that into their system, and then they start looking at how can I disaggregate these pieces and make use of them. These two speakers present some really interesting perspective on that, because to take John first, from Sage's point of view, Sage is a very diverse publisher where, you know, there's a lot of monographic content, there's journal content, which is very article-focused, and then there's reference content, which is very granular in nature, and they're building a system that can manage all of these and can slice and dice and create new products, et cetera. Anthony is showing how they're actually doing that live at ASTD, where the kind of self-service model, et cetera, is really built on this very granular content. So getting back to the original question, the magazine publishers tend to be more granular, and they tend to have more diverse kinds of content. They're more likely to have videos and slideshows and sidebars and kind of new media things than book publishers do today, although book publishers are moving in that direction. So I'd like John and Anthony, do you have any comments on that kind of book versus magazine issue, if you have a perspective on that?
Yeah, this is Anthony. I definitely do. We had the intent through our CMS implementation to treat them equally, and they weren't, in terms of even just way upstream the types of authors that you deal with. The deadlines, you know, magazines have to go out every month, and books, you know, sometimes the pub dates can slip. So it's just, for me, it's completely different from very far upstream. Downstream, you know, you can deal with long form versus short form content. You can talk about that. For me, it really has to do with, I mean, the title of this webinar is Building Your Bottom Line with Strategic Content Management. And for me, the opportunities for reusing and adding more revenue by reusing your content are the same for magazines and books. So when I think of solutions that are going to build my bottom line and how I can leverage our content management work, I think of solutions that will give me revenue upside on both books and magazines. So I haven't gotten to the point where I'm saying, okay, I'm just going to build a revenue generating magazine app.
Yep. Okay, great. And John, anything from you on that?
score?
I'd echo what both of you have said there. I really don't have anything additional to add.
Yeah, that's fine, because actually this kind of leads into another one of the questions, which is, this is a really fundamental one. What do I do right now to get my digital revenue to increase? Any tips that you would recommend? So, the question came in directed at me, but I actually really want to redirect it to the two publishers. I guess my perspective is the ability to create. There's two important distinctions to keep in mind. One is versions of products. Okay, that's still a very product focused strategy. But you're saying, okay, I've got my book or my magazine, et cetera. It's created for print. Can I put it online? Can I put it in an EPUB? Can I put it on the Kindle or not? Can I put it on the Kindle Fire or not? Do I put it in the iBook store or do I make an app, et cetera? But the important thing is having your content in a well-structured state, ideally in a repository like these two publishers are doing, so that you have the ability to reuse that content without going way back upstream. I deal with publishers where I will swear this is the actual truth. This is a very large publisher where they were creating publications from XML, but because of the nature of the workflow, which was not being managed by a system like this, at the end of the day, the print publication was the authoritative publication. And to do a revision or to use any of that content, they had to recreate the XML from the PDFs of the print in order to have reliable content. And that's just tragic. So, John and Anthony, any tips in terms of what to do right now to get digital revenue to increase?
I'll take this one first, though. This is John.
Good.
A couple of thoughts just off the top. I mean, one, you have to have good partnerships. But good partnerships don't get the content out there. And so, as you said, I mean, getting into the being able to repurpose your content, you need to be able to do it fast and cheap. I think something, when you get into the book side and the revenue models that are out there, there's not a lot of money to be made, so you're dealing with digital pennies. And so to make sure that you're making the right money, you have to be able to do things very quickly and very affordably and of high quality as well. And so a system like this will help us not only take in the content but manage it effectively and be able to automate the process of getting it in the right formats and getting it out to the partners as fast as possible. And very reliably out to the right partners. So it's kind of a multi-stage step, and it goes all the way back up to, as you said, I hate to use the term, but XML first. Just having your content in the right format from the beginning and being able to get it into the system to then handle it and then move it back out.
Yeah. I have to say I should apologize for making such a strong case about those meaningless terms. They're obviously not meaningless terms, and I don't want to discourage people from talking about XML or indexing or XML first or whatever. My point is you really need to define what you mean when you say those things. So, I should pull back a little bit on that. Thanks. Anthony, any perspective from you on that revenue issue?
I think it depends. I think the opportunities are proportional to how big your repository is, and if you can break off something like, let's say you are a publisher that happens to have like a handbook that is tops in your industry, and you like the body of knowledge. Well, you can just kind of break that off and make a very specialized, for lack of a better term, app that is. Digital and interactive and just wonderful, and it happens to be your most popular thing that you produce. But if you have a large repository and you're thinking, oh, I need to increase revenues for really all of my assets, I have multiple project codes, multiple business lines, you're really dealing with something like John was talking about that is a multi-year investment, and at that point you're dealing with very I guess, long-term P&L statements.
Yep. And I guess I'd like to add one other thought to this revenue question, which brings up one of my favorite subjects, which is metadata. If you have good metadata on your content, the simple, quick way to increase revenue is the ability when somebody buys product A from you to realize that products B, C, and D are probably of interest to them too, and give a very streamlined way of making sure they know that and they get presented with that information, and it's really good metadata that makes that work. So,
actually, if I can jump in and react to that, that's actually one mistake that I had made, is that I didn't think of the full life cycle early enough, and that you can spend a lot of money enriching your metadata, but if there's nothing to get it out to, then it's kind of pointless. And so what I would have done is I would have taken a section of our content, enriched that with better metadata, and then put it up on our web stores to at least have one of our product types be available for that recommendation engine that you just described. And there was just too long of a time between when we had created our taxonomy, enriched our metadata to the point when we could actually see the benefits of it from the end user perspective.
Yeah, that's a really essential point. I'm so glad you made that, because really in all aspects of this, not just the metadata, but really everything that you're doing, you always have to step back and say, what's the point of this? Why am I doing this? What is this going to accomplish? That may sound obvious when I state it so baldly like that, but oftentimes that's not the case, because people get on on the bandwagon on something and say, oh, we've got to enrich all this metadata, or we've got to create all this XML. I work for a firm that creates lots of XML for people, and it's sometimes tragic to see somebody, saying, I've got, X thousand books. I want to create XML. And we say, well, how do you want that XML tagged? What are you going to do with it? And they really haven't thought about that. They just know they want XML. It's like, no. You have to think about what it's for and what it's going to accomplish and what are you going to do with it when you have it. So, yeah, very, very, very good point. A couple of the questions, we've got kind of a cluster of questions that are all around how to evaluate content management systems and vendors. One questioner is asking about, avoiding pitfalls, what things to keep in mind. Another is asking about, how you select the technology for a CMS. Another one is asking about the benefits that you're looking for, et cetera. So any comments from the two publishers on just kind of how you went about making that technology decision in the first place? And let me ask that question in kind of a leading way, because I suspect that it is not one decision that's done and then you're done with it, right? In other words, you've got a continuing process of evolution, and but you're still making a commitment at some point to say, I'm using this platform, I'm adopting these technologies, et cetera. So what are the thought processes and the pitfalls from the publisher's point of view?
I'm happy to take this one first. This is John again from Sage. A couple just quick thoughts I'll throw out there. First, we really needed to understand what kind of technology we wanted to use. And in the case of having a lot of XML content, we really actually wanted to be able to hold this in a native XML repository. So knowing that and looking back to 2005, there were a few possible solutions we could use, but the underpinning of the technology that we liked a lot was MarkLogic. Of course, building on MarkLogic alone and having to do a lot of those things didn't look that appealing to us, and we did not have the development staff in-house at that point. And so what we needed was a good partner to actually help us with the technology that needed to sit on top of MarkLogic, the check-ins, the checkouts, management of the different different versions of the files and so forth, and then custom business rules altogether. And our suite was a beautiful tool that sat on top of that system and already had those features and functions that we needed. So from there, what we needed to understand is, did it have the right APIs for us to call in and write the business rules that we needed to accomplish the custom things that our suite did not natively do? And it did work. And so, we kind of had to really look at what we were trying to accomplish and then what we might be trying to accomplish in the future. So would the APIs support other things that we might get into? Would the system scale properly? Were the costs going to be effective for what we could do? And so the process was a little easier than one would think, because the systems were actually pretty – the system we chose with our suite and MarkLogic was pretty solid.
Great. Anthony, any comments from you on that score?
Yeah. My number my number one priority is the community. I don't know how I kind of ended up there, but it just kind of has come up time and time again from, you know, choosing our suite, choosing a new website CMS, or just multiple technology selections, that I found that if the community around this piece of software is robust and growing, then a lot of other things, I mean, I'm just assuming that if you're a .NET house, you're going to pick a .NET technology. I mean, those kinds of big decisions aside, community is just so important, because you have a pool of people to share ideas. You can leverage code, you know, code that one person has built off of, and it all just kind of snowballs. And you never want to be left with the CMS vendor that nobody really likes, and you're trying to find a developer to augment it, because, you know, I mean, it's just not growing. So that's my my big platform is the community around the software, the people.
That's a really interesting perspective, and I'm glad you brought that up. And actually, that leads to another kind of cluster of questions that we've got that are more on the kind of HR human resources side. You're talking about kind of an external community, obviously, in terms of others in the wide world that are, you know, using the same technology and can help each other. Most of these questions are more inward focused in terms of kind of the skill sets of the people involved. You know, one is about, are there any particular in-house skill sets that people should consider when mapping CMS business requirements? And I guess I had a question that kind of complements that, which is, you know, how did you find the process of the staff adjusting to working in this new way? Are there any particular sides of your operation that took to it more quickly, were very resistant to it? Was there a lot of retraining involved? Any advice you'd have for publishers who are implementing a CMS on the kind of HR personnel side?
John, you want me to go first?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I would. I don't look for things that that will make. Just to answer this specific question, I look for the. I try to remove the toxic things. So I try to remove people from the equation that don't really understand the business results, or I try to remove from the situation people that, you know, are so set in their ways, and that's a way to really get the ball rolling with success. And I guess, again, because this is a, you know, building your bottom line type thing, the number one thing that I would recommend is to try to align yourselves with people within the organization that understand either how good workflow will reduce expenses, or how good workflow will be able to help you increase your revenues by building new products. So you really just have to get those people aligned within your organization.
Did you pull together basically kind of a team or a skunk works, as it were? Kind of a cross-functional group, which is often the case. One thing that I often see as a benefit of the CMS implementation is that it kind of helps break down the internal silos that are so typical in most organizations. Did you find that, Anthony?
Yeah. So actually the workflow mapping that we did for our R-Suite implementation was the first time that we had gotten everybody in the same room, and it was like, even if we hadn't done a CMS implementation, it would have been worth it just to get those people in the room just to talk about, oh, that's what you do? Oh, that's the woman that I see walking down? It was an amazing transformation. And then within the actual, you know, getting kind of your stakeholders together, there was one person with each division that was going to use this workflow that yeah. was really identified as the champion.
Well, those are both good things. I got a big smile on my face, which on a webinar you can't see when you were saying those things. I've heard that from so many publishers that, you know, just getting people to sit down together and understand what each other is doing is a huge benefit of this. And it's so tragic that doesn't happen. John, did you find that as well?
Yeah, Absolutely. I have a lot of answers to add on to all of this. I think some of the most – Anthony was just dead on his answer. A couple additional points I'll add within the SAGE environment was so on a front of deploying, I think the most important thing that you actually need is a person or a set of people that know how the business runs or that can envision what they want the business to run like, that can cut through what is happening today and clearly see what needs to happen tomorrow. If you don't have a business lead on top that can actually help write the requirements, you just will never succeed. So that's far more important than having an actual developer sitting on the staff or anything else. It needs to be a clear-minded person that can get the requirements set. From there, obviously you do need people that will engage with you on the process. You do need to have open minds to figure out what the process is going to be to get the right system in place and then get the processes around it properly. And then we found, sure, it doesn't hurt to have good technology, a backbone to help either do development or guide the developers that you use. But those resources are available out there if you do need them to do the actual technical development. It's still the business requirements, the business analysts that are the most important piece.
Great, thank you. Well, this is a terrific input from both of you folks. We have actually hit the 3 o'clock hour, which is our endpoint. We can go a couple more minutes if people need to. I think we have actually covered most of the questions pretty well. Any questions that haven't been specifically answered, we will get back to the questioner and make sure that you get a response to your question. So, Brian, anything more at this point that you need from me?
No, I think that'll just about do it for this webinar. I want to thank everyone who attended and certainly everyone on the panel. I think a lot of great information, and hope everyone got a lot of good tips. On behalf of Book Business and our suite, I want to thank everyone so much for attending the webinar. Please be sure to check out our webinar page at bookbusinessmag.com to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And please keep your eyes on your email inbox for an offer for the white paper that Book Business and RSI are working on, delving further into the topic and featuring more case studies on strategic content management. And if you would take just a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, we would be grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. I hope to, quote, see you at the next Book Business webinar. Thanks, everyone.